up, get out right out of your bed, that's your quicksand. Getting rid anxiety and head, you can fix it. Rid of stigmas, all of them you said, we ain't listening. Just remember, try to do your best, you can win this.
Maurice Bernard, State of Mind.
All right, this is State of Mind. How are you? If you like what you see, hit this button right here, this little red button. Where is it? Right here? Maybe here? Okay, whatever. Yeah, because we're trying to get to the other. We're trying to hit 200,000 subscriptions, and 100 was a tough one. But we'll see. Okay. Today, I want to talk to you about one thing first. You remember Tyler Gerrard? I did a couple years ago. Great interview. Young man, about 20, I don't know, 27, 25, whatever. He was in Thailand and he spent 7 years in a Thailand prison for a crime he didn't commit. If you can imagine what that's like, you know, the stories he would tell me about them keeping the lights on 24 hours, and anytime he tried to go to sleep, they'd make a noise. Can you imagine the mental health going on there? Sleeping in a room with 100 people? But he finally got out. I can't get into what's going on now, but he finally got out. And that is just, it was beautiful. It's hope. And who I have today is another story. Traumatic. But it's a story of hope and what a wife and somebody else. I'm getting choked up. Hold on. What I would imagine two people could do for someone. Save their life, save, you know, I mean, just amazing. And to me, that's like godsend. Anyway, let's get into it. This person was jailed in Japan for negligent driving that resulted in the death of two people and was recently transferred to the United States. He's been paroled, released from U.S. prison. A Navy lieutenant. His name is Ridge Alconis. And my friend, Andrew Eubanks, who pretty much did so much for him and that it's amazing. Saved his life. What's going on? How you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, much better than I was a few months ago.
Wow, man. What I want to do is, before we get into the whole situation, I want to get to know you guys a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like, where'd you grow up? I know the whole nine yards.
Okay, I was born here in Los Angeles, born Torrance Memorial Hospital, not too far from where we are today.
Wow.
My father, born and raised in Los Angeles. My dad was a LA County firefighter, and so we lived in a few places around the city, but went to high school in Claremont, California, the east side of LA County. And yeah, enjoyed a good childhood until I went to the Naval Academy after I graduated high school. And
What made you want to go into the Navy? I mean,
I've always been really interested in a kind of a service, focused career path, and that allowed for that. There was some a financial aspect of, as well. I mean, to go to the Naval Academy provides you with a great education for zero cost. And that was a big plus for me. And to have an automatic job on the back end where I got to serve those around me and the nation as a whole was an added benefit. And I mean, on top of that, I got to meet great people while I was there, to include the guy sitting next to me, Andrew Eubanks.
Oh, that's where you met?
Yes.
How'd you guys meet?
As a small school. So there's only about 4,000 kids there.
No. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. So even though, I mean, he'll tell you his side of the story. He's from a much different part of the country. But yeah, from we were 18, 19 years old when we met, and we've been friends ever since.
Oh, man, this is a movie. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, so when you were young, you were what kind of kid were you in school and stuff like that?
Oh, I mean, I got good grades. I'm the oldest of five kids. Great family. I got a mom and a dad that would do anything for me.
No mental health.
No mental health issues. More support than I could ever imagine. And I never thought. I mean, coming from a background like that, I never in a million years would have thought that I would have had to go through what I did. And have had to kind of galvanize my mind, my thoughts, the way that I did to survive the last 2-3 years. Yeah.
But in a way, Ridge, good that you didn't have any mental illness. Because that adds, even you went through mm-hmm. that and then you would have been. Mm-hmm. So thank God for that, mm-hmm. right? Now, what your wife and...
Yeah.
Brittany, right?
Yeah, my wife, Brittany, she's my champion. She's, I call her my superhero. And she is nothing short of it. She did more for me. Her and the guy sitting next to me, Andrew, they did more for me than anybody else. And she fought tirelessly until I came home and continues to do so as the mother of our kids and my wife. And I just could not be more grateful and for everything that she did for me and
so
our family.
What was your life like before the situation? Let's call it the situation. Then
okay.
Then we'll get into it. Before the situation, because then you tease the audience.
Yeah.
What was your life like? I mean, just pretty much nice and, you know.
Yeah, I was living a great... My wife likes to tell people that we were the happiest we'd ever been before what happened. And I've got three kids. They're now 10, 8, and 6. We had recently moved to Japan as part of a new assignment for me as the weapons officer on a destroyer based out of Japan. And I was about to deploy, and in preparation for that, we were trying to give the kids an opportunity to have a little trip or to do something fun with me before I left for the next 6 to 8 months. And so...
Happy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we were busy and we had our trials for sure, but yeah, we were happy. We were in as good of a place as we had experienced as a family.
And where did you meet Brittany?
In Annapolis, where the Naval Academy is. So I was a junior at the time, and yeah, we dated through the rest of my time at the Naval Academy, and then we got married right after I graduated.
That's amazing. Well, I met my wife when she was 16, but wow. So how about you? Tell me some stuff about you, because I want to get into what we were talking about before. That's very mm-hmm. important.
Sure, yeah. Before I get into a little bit of my background, I just want to say one thing that Ridge left out, though, is he was a college baseball player. He was recruited as a pitcher for the baseball team.
That was a different life, though.
Wait, Ridge, wait a minute. You were that good?
Yeah, I mean...
A pitcher?
Division one collegiate pitcher right here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a part of why I wanted to go to the Naval Academy too. They gave me an opportunity to continue my career for sure. And I appreciated that. And had some great times on the field.
Wow. But why didn't you go that way?
Because I wasn't good enough, unfortunately. Yeah, I was good enough Yeah. So I mean, it took me where I wanted it to take me. I wanted to.
Then you knew you couldn't get to that level.
Yeah, not without some serious sacrifice. And I mean, but no, I wasn't good enough. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Yeah. I was good enough to play Division I high level collegiate baseball, but that was it for me, and that was good enough.
See, that's smart to know that. To know that you know, it's like actors who think they can be, and I'm going, not really. So, Andrew, what was your thing growing up, and how many brothers and sisters, and how was your
mom and dad? I grew up on a farm in the middle of Arkansas.
Oh my goodness.
Yep, I grew up on a farm and just cattle and poultry. And so I grew up working on the farm with my family. I have two older brothers and older sister. And so it was just outside a lot, working on the farm with the family a lot. I grew up. And then I also got accepted to the Naval Academy and went there and studied. And I played rugby in college.
Rugby?
Rugby, yep. So maybe I didn't have any mental health challenges growing up, but maybe it was all those knocks on the head and rugby that did it. I don't know.
Is rugby, I mean, rugby, you just hit with no pads, and what is that the way it is?
It is no pad, like a kind of a mix between football and soccer, but no pads and just a lot of crazy people. You know, they say that, you know, they went to a bar and a rugby match broke out.
Yeah.
But yeah, very rough sport, but had a blast playing. And then after I graduated, Ridge, he stayed in the Navy, and I actually transitioned into the Marine Corps, and I was a Marine Corps helicopter pilot for 11 years.
Whoa.
And during that time, I also got married, and I have four kids. My two oldest were actually born within a few weeks of Ridge's two oldest. And so our kids are friends, and our families have been really close for the last 12 years, 15 years, and we've been on vacations together, and just great friendship.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Now we had to talk about some mental health stuff, and you put it, I love the way you were talking about it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So during the last few years of my Marine Corps career, that was when Ridge was, wrongfully imprisoned in Japan. And so when that happened, there was no way I was just going to let my friend be unjustly imprisoned like that and not do anything, because I know how good of a person he is. And I believe in due process and fairness, and that's not what he got. And so I started what we eventually named the Bring Ridge Home Movement.
Yes.
And so I worked hand in hand with his wife to eventually, create an international movement to bring him home and to get him released from prison, which we finally achieved miraculously in January. But I was doing all this, leading this movement, which was pretty much like running a kind of an advocacy campaign, a business almost. While I was also trying to raise my family, and
a lot of stress was happening.
Oh, a ton of stress. So okay. I was a full-time Marine. So I had, a full-time career that I was working on. My wife was about to give birth to our fourth child.
Oh yeah.
I had just moved from Hawaii to Washington, D.C. So like the kids weren't in a great school. And so there were some challenges there. And then I was also in the process of getting ready to move to leave the Marine Corps. And I was applying to business schools. Applying to schools, trying to figure out, okay, like I'm leaving this career. What's my next career going to be? Where are we going to live?
Yeah.
And also like having meetings at the White House and with Congress, trying to like advocate for Ridge.
Yeah.
It was very stressful for me. And that kind of turned into anxiety and panic attacks. And then that turned into depression.
Now, you didn't have this before?
No.
So this is the first time you're feeling it.
The first time. And so when I first started feeling the severe stress, it was like I could like feel it in my arms, like in my veins. And I was like, what is this? I don't like this feeling.
No.
Doesn't feel good. And then when the panic attacks happened, it was just, I didn't know what was happening. And same thing with the depression, I was like, I've always been a very high achieving, high performing individual, always a lot of mental clarity, able to like kind of brush off stress, no problem sleeping. And now I was just in this like dark place. And so I started exercising more. I hired a personal trainer.
Yeah.
I went to the doctor. They gave me some medication. I started seeing a counselor. I was like doing all the things that I would encourage someone else to do.
Yeah.
But nothing was getting better. I was getting worse. And so I just kept going to a darker and darker place throughout this process. And it just wasn't a good thing.
You're probably feeling what I feel been happening lately a lot is your mind, you can't stop your mind. The nightmare of your thoughts in your mind does not stop. And that's the scariest thing. And, you know, but you know, here's the thing though. I'll tell you right now, because it just happened to me. God is a big part of my life. So every morning I journal and I, you know, pray and I do things. So with this bout of anxiety that was really bad, it's been worse in my life, trust me, but it was pretty bad. I just dealt with it on my own. I prayed, help me God, help me God. Crying, 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 crying. My wife's like, take the Xanax. And I'm like, so I did take Xanax, a little thing. And you know what? Usually I'll take Xanax at night and I sleep great. That works, right? It's great. Just a tiny little thing, right? But I took it in the day and I calmed down. But I knew it was like a Band-Aid that eventually it would come back, and it did 3 hours later and worse. And then I'm again crying, going berserk, mind's going. And my wife's like, take another. I said, no, I'm not taking another Xanax. I'm not taking it. And guess what? I got through it on my own. And that's kind of a good lesson, because we can get through it. So you were having that kind of feeling and you never had it before.
Nope.
So then what?
So eventually things were just getting so bad, and I was just having a really bad intrusive thoughts.
Oof.
And there was self-harm and just a bad place. And so I got to the point where I was like, hey, I've done everything I know I could do, you know, counselor.
Yes.
Fitness.
Yes.
Medication. And I was just going in a worse and worse spot. And so eventually I was just like, I told my wife, like, hey, I need like a significant intervention here to like save my life, to like get drastic help. And so I went to Walter Reed, the military hospital in Washington, D.C. in Bethesda. And I checked myself into the psych ward there for inpatient mental health care. And that was super scary going there. I was like scared to do it, because at the time I felt like I was throwing my life away. I was like, oh, if you go in here, like the stigma, it's going to stick with you. Your reputation's going to be ruined. You're never going to have any professional success. But for me, I knew that no, whether that was true or not, and assuming it was true, like it still wasn't going to replace like being the husband and father I wanted to be.
Right.
And that without this help, I could never be the husband and father that I wanted to be and that my family needed me to be.
And what was the span of that? How many weeks of you going
in the hospital
when you were going through all this stuff?
So I would say the severe stress and anxiety started in August, September of 2022. And then I checked myself into the hospital in March of 2023. So just a year ago.
You were going through all that for that long?
I was. Maybe it's the Marine in me, just hard-headed, stubborn, don't like to like admit defeat or something, but yeah.
Man. I mean, I went 4 months through the pandemic of what you're going through, actually. But that's 4 months, but wow. So then what?
So then I got out of the hospital, and because of some challenges with the military healthcare system that I don't need to get into now, it just took a long time to get plugged into getting help. So I kind of like,
sorry, Andrew, can I interrupt you for 1 second about that?
Yes.
I might get in trouble, but I'm going to say this. it's hard to get mental health help. What the f***? Sorry to swear, but it's YouTube. You know, my wife said it. She goes, honey, you got to talk about on State of Mind. This is a perfect opportunity. It is, you know, during the pandemic, I understand it was a pandemic, but I was ready to go. I couldn't get help with everything that I've done with mental health. I couldn't get help. Took 4 months, well, 3.5 months. What's happening with this? What is it? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't know. I just know that there's one, there's just not enough providers. I know that's one of the issues. It's hard to find a provider that you feel like a connection with.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
right,
hard.
Right.
But I know, like, with the military healthcare system, from the time you, like, raise your hand and say, hey, like, I think I need some help, it's usually like, I need help, like, now, like, today. And by the time they give you through a referral and the referral line and plugged in and insurance and this and that, it's 2 to 3 months before you finally see anyone. So here I was like, I've just been in a psych ward in the hospital. Like, I think, like, I need help now. Like, this, I don't have months. And so, but unfortunately that's what I took. And so I ended up going even to a darker and getting worse and worse and worse after I left the hospital. And what happened was I eventually finally got plugged in with a psychiatrist. It was like, hey, this medication, I don't know. And they're like, we need to change your medication. And it turns out the medication I was on just
made it worse. Oh my
And
goodness.
So once I switched medications to a new one, it was like almost night and day difference. It was so much better. And that allowed me to at least like get to a point where I could start doing other things that allowed me to manage it and kind of slowly start overcoming the different challenges. And so, you know, now I focus a lot more on self-care and doing other more holistic methods of, like, you know, addressing the anxiety, the stress, depression, things like that. And so being aware of it has been super helpful. But that's what I do now. And since getting out of the Marine Corps, I eventually was working in corporate tech as a consultant for a while. That wasn't a good fit. So I got out. Now I'm doing coaching and consulting for leadership and mindset. And so I help people who hate their jobs and are unhappy in their life that want to make big career pivots to and create the life that they love, that they're actually excited to get out of bed in the morning and feel alive again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I coach people through that, through usually 12 weeks of coaching, a program that I developed. And that's really fulfilling to be able to help people kind of get to create a life that they want, that they're happy in, and that they're healthy in. Because I've been there where you're not happy, you're in a dark place, and you dream of a better life, and you just don't know how to get there. And I was lucky enough to find some people that helped me, and so that's what I'm doing now.
But you seem good now.
I feel good.
Damn. But you know what? What I say? When we go through you two, Ridge, obviously, we'll get to it in about 5 seconds here. When we all hear, and the guy just had the same thing, when you go through this stuff, if we take the right measures, you become a better person. And the least that you are is interesting. Because we're interesting because of what we've been through. And we can even be great because of what we've been through. We have to just know, I just said it, you know, this week with this stuff, I could close my eyes and what came was suffering is learning. We don't learn from the joy and the happiness. We learn from everything that we go through. So we have to see suffering as kind of not the enemy. I know it's hard, man. But
I agree. And that was a big mindset shift for me as well, from starting to shift my mind to it, my life purpose being about becoming a better person,
yeah,
rather than checking boxes or accomplishments or achievements and focusing on just becoming. And that was huge because a life coach that I had, he helped me see that my suffering and pain and those trials that you're talking about, they're helping me become a better person. Because you know, I look at it now, like all the people that, as I share about mental health, all the people that reach out to me, I mean, incredible people that you would never expect to have mental health challenges. they're coming out of the woodworks and telling me like, thank you for sharing and opening up. Like I have this too, or I had this, it's hard. And so, you know, through this really hard, you know, 18, 24 months, I've learned to empathize with this giant percentage of the world of humanity and what they experience. And I can empathize and help those people now, whereas before I wasn't in a position to do that.
Right. Yeah. Because the thing is this, that's why I'm able to do what I do, because people know what I've been through, mm-hmm. you know? So it's like, I'm the bipolar dude, you know? So if I talk about stuff, you're going to believe it because I've lived it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with you now. Before you could have done it, but no, it wouldn't be as successful.
No.
But now that you've been through it, especially for you, the first time is really tough, because that's why the pandemic opened up a lot of people's eyes. Those people who said, he's depraved. He's not really there. He'd just go to sleep and it'd be fine. Those people during the pandemic, they felt stuff and they're like, oh, this is it. Mm-hmm. It's scary first mm-hmm. time. All right, Ridge. How are you?
You know, every day is its own hurdle, but I'm, like I said before, I'm much better than I was prior to a few months ago.
So what I want you to do, kind of like a movie,
mm-hmm.
take me, how about right before a week or whatever, mm-hmm. you went to Japan, or you were, I don't remember, whatever happened in that situation, mm-hmm. I want you to take me through the whole situation.
Okay. I'm gonna ask Andrew to kind of pinch hit on some of this stuff, because it's a little bit.
Andrew, what you just did was really beautiful for me, because I loved listening to what you said. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so some of it is still very traumatic for me, and reliving it is extremely difficult. So I'm gonna ask him to kind of pitch in a little bit on some of it.
But whatever you want.
Leading up to it, I had been recently assigned to the weapons officer on USS Benfold, and was getting acclimated to a new crew and a new ship and everything that goes along with just being in a new situation and a new job title. And I was enjoying it. And my kids were getting settled in the school, and we had lived in Japan previously. And so we were comfortable there. And like I said, we wanted to give each kid an opportunity to do something with me before I left on deployment. My second child wanted to climb to the top of Mount Fuji, a famous mountain in Japan, and then go to an ice cream shop that's at the bottom of the mountain that they had been to as children, babies. So they knew that it existed. They'd seen the pictures, but they couldn't remember it. And so they wanted to go. And so the weekend before I was scheduled to leave on deployment, we got in the car and I had a full night's sleep. I think I'd sleep 8 or 9 hours the night before, drove the two and a half hours to the mountain, and then hiked up to just over 8,000 feet, I believe. And then once we'd gotten high enough, it was me, my three kids who were young at the time, and my wife and our family dog. We hopped back in the car and started heading back down towards the mountain. And that was kind of the start of where my life took a major turn.
Yeah, I'll kind of hop in to kind of finish the story there a little bit. But as they were driving down the mountain to this ice cream spot, Ridge was talking to his oldest daughter, having a conversation, and in the middle of the conversation, just completely blacked out, lost consciousness, slumped over, and the car drifted across the road and hit several parked cars in a parking lot. And those parked cars, kind of like a domino effect, eventually hit a few pedestrians in the parking lot. And tragically, two people died, and we mourn for them and their families, and we pray for them. But it was just this terrible situation of, like, you know, the airbags went off, they hit the cars, and nothing woke him up. Because he wasn't asleep, he had lost consciousness from some kind of medical condition at the time. His wife eventually had to, like, get out, open the door, pull him out, and wake him up kind of eventually. But rather than going to a hospital and seeing, like, what's wrong, the authorities just arrested him and took him to jail and put him in solitary confinement for 26 days for 26 days.
Oh my goodness.
And then just interrogated them for 26 days with no lawyer present, no adequate translation, no medical attention, until they finally got him to sign something in Japanese that he couldn't read, that said he had negligently fallen asleep in the middle of the day with his family, which wasn't true. And there was no drugs or alcohol involved or ever suspected. But that was 26 days of being sleep deprived. Talk about like no lights in Thailand, yeah, same yeah, thing right. there. Yeah. No, they never turn the lights off. So you're sleep deprived.
Losing weight.
Yeah. Yeah. Lost a lot of weight.
But yeah, just kind of, it was just a huge shock for him and obviously for us, because I've spent a lot of time in Japan as a service member and also as a civilian. Ridge has spent most of his adult life in Japan.
Oh, really?
And so we love Japan, and we both have spent time there and worked with the Japanese military forces, and always had a great experience. And so this was the first time that we became aware of like kind of Japan's darker side, which is this hostage justice system, which they are known for, in which they just kind of, if you're suspected of a crime, you're interrogated, you have no right to a lawyer, you have no right to really like try and prove your innocence once they decide that you're guilty. And so Ridge was eventually got out on parole after 26 days, but then was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison.
3 years?
Mm-hmm.
And what was happening at this time? And you weren't drunk.
No.
They can prove that.
No, well, that was, so when I was initially handcuffed and taken out, the first thing that I asked for, I say, I want a drug and alcohol test right now.
Right.
Because that's what I was afraid of, that I was going to be charged with, or that I was going to be accused of. But they wouldn't even do that for me. They wouldn't even give me a blood alcohol test or any sort of drug test. They said, no, we know you weren't drunk. We know you weren't under the influence of any drugs. So like, you don't need it. I said, you don't understand. That's what everyone's going to think. I mean, this accident happened at 1 o'clock in the afternoon with three kids and a dog and my wife in the passenger seat. This is different and people are going to think this, but couldn't even get that much medical care.
And your family, they can't be witnesses, right? Or can they?
No. So,
can't they save?
No, my daughter, my oldest daughter, who I was in mid conversation with, obviously saw the accident, and no, they decided not. The Japanese authorities decided not to interview her, and not to allow her testimony into the courtroom.
So then, now you spent that time in solitary, and I'm sure that was same with Tyler in Thailand. It's horrific. Why they would do that is beyond me, but that's, you know, they do what they do. Then what happens when?
So then starts the next about a year long legal battle, and
now you're still in prison.
No, so then I was released on bail.
Oh, okay.
After those initial 26 days. And I was on bail. I did a day or two in prison over the next year. But for the most part, I was out on bail. And that was really where the most of my kind of my mental health struggles with anxiety and uncertainty really was at its peak, because there was just, I didn't understand what was happening to me. I didn't fully understand the powers that were kind of driving my life at the time. I felt very helpless and out of control of my own life, and just didn't know what was going to happen. And that uncertainty really.
So you'd be in court and you don't, and these people are all speaking Japanese, because Tyler would tell me that in Thailand, he didn't understand anything that was going on.
No. And I am blessed with some language ability, but it is a legal terms are not something that I was familiar with.
Yeah.
And, wow. We did have some translating services in the courtroom, but those were less than adequate, I would say.
That's what he said.
And that made it difficult to kind of navigate that whole process. But even outside of what happened in the courtroom, the sitting around and waiting for the decisions is just terrible. I mean, that's really, you know, what's going to happen to me? My life is on pause. until this is all resolved, and not having a purpose really. And I think that was a big part of it too. I couldn't execute my job as I was used to being able to do, because I was stuck waiting for my legal process to play out. I felt like I couldn't develop any sort of lasting relationships or skills because I had this black cloud hanging over me.
Now, where was Brittany and the kids?
They were with me the whole way.
Oh, they were. Yeah, that's at least a.
Yes, but I think if she was here, she would tell you. I mean, those were some of the hardest days that we've ever had. Was during that process, and she went through, and my kids too. My kids are absolute warriors to have to go through what they did.
So you have what, a little girl?
I've got two little girls and a little boy. Damn. Yeah.
So you guys would all be together.
Yep.
And dad, we're going to do this. It's going to have, you know, everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you do your best to kind of shield them from a lot of, but as you know, I mean, when you're dealing with that level of stress, anxiety, it is hard to shield it from anybody, especially the people that live in your home.
And
so they got to see the good, the bad, and the ugliest.
Could you work out? Could you go for a run?
I was as fast as I've ever been. And I tried to pump some of that anxiety and stress and depression into the pavement and deal with it that way. And it definitely helped, but there's just,
that's a lot of stress.
It's a lot of stress, and there's no off switch. It's always there. It's not something that you can just walk away from. And so,
because you know, a prison in Japan, can you imagine? That's like, you don't want to.
No, it very isolated. So that was my experience of pre-confinement. Then once all my appeals had played out and my reality was going to prison, I had to kind of shift my mindset and say, okay, my new reality is, hey, I'm going to prison. And how am I going to deal with this? And
okay, hold on. I would die, man. I would die if that were me.
Well,
you're strong. I mean,
I had I people like Andrew, my wife, my kids, they deserved a version of me that was at least as good as I was the day I went into prison when I came out. And so when I went into it, you talked about, hey, when you go through something hard, when you go through a struggle, you want to use that to make you a better person.
Yeah.
Well, that attitude is really what got me through it. I said, hey, I'm going to do whatever I can to make this time worthwhile. I mean, this is not ideal. This is not something that I would wish on anybody, but that doesn't mean it has to be all bad.
Perfect.
Yeah. And actually, so perfect, one of the things in Japanese prison, it's very isolated.
What is that? But like, what do you mean? Like no one's around or what?
There's people around. So I was only allowed to talk freely an hour and 15 minutes a day. So I got a 15 minute break from 9:30 to 9:45 where I could speak freely to the other prisoners. And then I got a 50 minutes to an hour of exercise time in the afternoon where I was able to freely converse with the people around me. Other than that, I had to raise my hand, ask very specific questions, and
back in your cell.
And back in my cell, yeah,
it's just
or back
you
to my
there?
Job. Yes, and then a lot of time spent alone in a cell. So
oh, God.
I did my first 100 days.
I think I'm getting anxiety right now, bro.
You know, my cells were anywhere from 6 by 12 feet to 5 by 10 feet, depending on the flavor of the prison or the section of the prison I was in.
And on weekends and holidays, they're not allowed out of their cell. And so there's no exercise time on weekends and holidays. So during that time, every Saturday and Sunday, or if Monday's a holiday too, 3 days in a row, you're just in your cell alone by yourself. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to sleep. You're not allowed to really move around or do anything, right?
No, just
sit there.
What's that size of cell? Like what's the size of the cell? Like
six. So I would say it's about
like
the width.
Like what we're here, right here?
Yeah. It's long and narrow. So yeah, I'd say about the width is close, but you know, then you're, the length is as long as this room, and then the width would be about your arm span, your wingspan. So, but you learn how to live with that. You know, I created little.
Yeah, what did you do, man?
I read a lot of books.
That's the thing I wanted to say. 194?
192 books. And that's a conservative estimate. There's probably a few more in there that didn't make the list. But wow. Yeah, so I read a ton of books. I made little tricks. So when I was in those, you know, I spent my first 100 days straight in a cell, barely left at all, 2 15-minute showers a week. And I would say, okay, I got to walk. I got to at least, I got to move or else my body's going to deteriorate. So I would walk back and forth. I tried to walk 3 miles a day, 10 feet at a time. And then I would sing songs in my head and kind of dance back and forth. I would try and think of little problems to solve that it really had no value in a prison cell, but just I was fortunate enough to, right before I went in, I talked to a guy who had spent 3 years in a Russian prison, and he had kind of given me some tips about, hey, how do you handle isolation? And his big thing was, hey man, doesn't matter what it is, keep your brain working, solve problems. Doesn't matter if they're real or not, just keep solving problems.
It's kind of like anxiety.
Yeah. And so that's what I did. If I heard about something that was going on or I saw a little issue, then I would just think it to death.
No fights. Nobody tried to.
No, I mean, not too much in Japanese prison.
It's not like.
I was never fearful for my physical well-being. I'll put it that way. But mentally, emotionally, it was very taxing and took a lot of effort to keep my mind right. But mostly it was just, hey, there is a way for me to get better while I'm in here. I just got to go find it.
Yeah.
And so
any contact with Brittany?
Yep. So I got my visitation rights depended on my status within the prison. And so as you have continuous stretches of good behavior, then you earn more privileges. So in the beginning, I think I got 2 30-minute supervised visits. I never got any phone calls. All my visits were supervised through the plexiglass with the phone, like you see on the movies.
Damn. And
eventually that went up to 5 visits, but the visits are very unsatisfying. To have someone listen to your conversations and write down everything that you say. And I mean, especially when my kids were involved with that, to have someone
That's weird.
Sitting behind me writing down everything. And I never got no physical contact. You know, it was all through plexiglass. Yep. Holding up the hand.
You did that like in the movies?
Yep. We used to do that all the time.
And on soap operas.
Yeah.
And that was part of the isolating effect on him and us too, because not only in Japanese prison, there's no access to email or computers. There's no phone privileges. And he only was able to write 7 letters a month. So we could send him letters. We could send him a ton of letters, but he could only write 7 letters a month to send out.
What's the 7? I mean.
And that was another thing. That number increases as you gain higher status within the prison. And I don't know the ins and outs as to why the Japanese prison has such policies, but
it's
that was my life. It was just the reality I lived
in. So how did this gentleman
get involved,
get out, get you the whole thing, save?
Yeah. So I don't know exactly the time that it started, but I just remember my wife coming to see me one day, and she said that it's been overwhelming, the amount of people that are calling and emailing and texting. But Andrew called and said, hey, I'm going to take over. Like, I'm going to be your spokesperson. I'm going to be a buffer between you and the world for a little bit. And that's how it started. But it morphed into a whole lot more once I went into prison and kind of the advocacy side of it started, and dealing with politicians, dealing with various entities that required constant effort and persistence to ask for help and to create change. And he was at the forefront of that from day one.
Your wife weren't going to give up. That's just the way it worked.
Like at the beginning, I just knew that Brittany, she's an incredible woman and very capable. But I knew that at when the accident first happened, I knew she was like alone in this foreign country with Ridge in prison and probably very overwhelmed. And so I knew I remember I just told her, I said, hey, I would recommend just like have someone like a family member or a friend just kind of be like the gatekeeper. So, 'cause you're just being overwhelmed by people wanting to know what's going on, how's Ridge. because you're going to be overwhelmed. You can't handle all this. And she's like, well, can you do it? And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll just, so I kind of became like the buffer, the gatekeeper to like the Alconis family. And so that turned into coordinating letter writing campaigns to the White House, to members of Congress. That turned into meeting with members of Congress. And so eventually I was able to, with Brittany, build relationships with members of Congress in the Senate, in the House of both parties. I coordinated a lot of protests and demonstrations in front of the White House and around the Capitol. One day we did 18 simultaneous protests across America at one time. That was really cool. But eventually we made enough noise and got enough attention that we started working with the national media. So all the major news outlets, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, as well as all the major print outlets, Wall Street Journal,
Washington Post,
New York Times. So between all the kind of public advocacy we were doing, we eventually got the attention of the White House. And we got into the White House and had meetings with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and the National Security Council, and continued those relationships to like tell people like, hey, if we're going to send a service member overseas, like they should have the same constitutional rights to legal protection and due process that they would in America. If we're going to send them on America's errand, they should have due process if they're accused for a crime. We're not saying that they should be exempt from or immune from punishment if they commit a crime, but they should have the right to defend themselves. They should have the right to have a lawyer.
Yeah.
And that was not the case. And so, you know, we kept just, you know, advocating and working with the government as much as we could to try to apply as much pressure. And eventually an international treaty was used to transfer Ridge back to the United States in December of last year. So what, 4 months ago? And once he came back here, he was in the Metropolitan Detention Center here in Los Angeles, and the Department of Justice reviewed his case. And as soon as they reviewed his case, they ordered his immediate release because they knew it was obvious that there wasn't merit in keeping him in jail any longer. And so in January 12th, Ridge was ordered to be released from prison. And so Brittany and the kids, they drove up to Los Angeles from Orange County and picked him up and took him home.
That's a beautiful ending to a great movie.
Yeah. And that was a wild day. Wow. I remember I was able, once in the U.S. justice system, you're allowed to make phone calls. So I called every day at 8:30, and I called and my kids picked up and they should have been at school. And they said, daddy, we're coming to get you. You're getting out of jail today. And I said, no, I'm not. There's no way, because at that point there had been, because of all these activities on my behalf, I had gotten into a little bit of a habit of getting high, like maybe something good's going to happen and then crashing.
Yeah.
And so then I had to develop kind of a strategy to avoid that, because the peaks and valleys were mm-hmm. not helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of developed the mindset that, hey, this is my new life. I'm going to be in prison forever. Maybe one day it ends, but I can't think about when or how that day will come.
Right.
And so when the phone call came through that said it, I didn't believe it. And I didn't have the mental capacity to handle that information. So I remember hanging up the phone and just going and grabbing my book and going back into my cell. And I just kept reading. And my cellmate said, was that what just happened? I said, I think they just told me I'm going home today, but I'm not sure. And I didn't hit me until I walked out those doors by myself without anybody watching me or without any handcuffs on.
How's that feeling?
Oh man. I mean, that's a big part of the stress and anxiety that comes along with being in prison, is always being watched. You're always, and you're never being, and you're never trusted. It's always, you're always assumed to be doing something wrong or will be doing something wrong shortly. And the lift of that burden, on top of seeing my kids, like hugging my kids and seeing my mom and dad there and all my siblings, was, it's a day that I'll never forget.
Wow, man. I don't know what to say right now, but I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And
you too.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it, I mean, yeah, I had to endure what I had to, but the happy part of the story wasn't because of me. It was because of great people like my wife, like Andrew, and there's lots of others. I mean, those were kind of the two at the tip of the spear, but there were lots of others. I had thousands of champions Damn. That stood behind me until I, and would not waver. Mm-mm. And when you go through something like this, when you go, you need people like that, that you can lean on, that you can depend on for strength.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I kind of want to tell a quick story within this story yeah. about how your mindset and how you can create your own luck and create your own future.
Yes.
Because, you know, when we were Ridge, myself, we don't come from wealthy families. Right. We're not wealthy. His dad was a firefighter. My dad was a farmer. And we are not wealthy. We're not political huge political donors at the national level or anything. We don't have giant connections. And so it was like, you know, people would look at us like, well, how are you going to get to the White House? You know, like, who are you? And
that's true.
And Brittany, you know, when we started working on this, like, hey, we need to talk to the president. You know, we need to talk to the president and get the president to get Ridge released, like call Japan and negotiate on his behalf. And we would go to these meetings with different government officials. We would go to meetings with congressmen and senators, and their staff would be like, well, what do you need us to do? What do you want? And Brittany would say, we want to meet with the president. And she said it as if like, I have every right as an American right. citizen and the wife of a naval officer to meet with the commander in chief and demand help. And people would look at us like we were crazy. Like, who are you to think you're going to meet with the president? And they would give us like, you're out of your mind. That's not going to happen. You're never going to meet with the president. Well, we went to the State of the Union last year and we met the president.
Wow.
And Brittany talked and hugged the president and asked President Biden to like do what he can. And that was a huge like shift in like a getting more and more momentum to getting Ridge home.
Yeah.
And it took time because, you know, diplomatic channels and foreign policy and national security issues. It was a very, very complex situation, but we did it.
Damn.
You know, people said you'll never talk to the president. Well, we talked to the president. And, you know, what we accomplished by just having a mindset of like, we're going to do it. It doesn't matter how long, but we're not going to give up and we're going to keep working until it happens. It's amazing what you can do.
Yes.
When you're committed to creating your own luck and creating your own opportunities.
Yes. Because if he hadn't done that,
Still be there.
He'd be in Japan.
Yeah. And my wife and Andrew both, extremely, stubborn people that would not take no for an answer. And I think people continuously miscalculated their determination and strength to see me home.
Yeah.
And that ultimately is what created a lot of opportunity, is just that persistent, consistent effort that outlasted others.
Yeah. Because maybe the others will give up a lot sooner.
And that's it. And you talk about mental health, and I'm sure at being bipolar and yeah. having struggles, ups and downs. Yeah. But you know what? It doesn't matter how many times you go down. You just got to keep getting up.
Yes.
Because that's what matters. You just keep getting up every day and you just keep going.
Yeah.
That's all you can do sometimes.
Yeah. As hard as it is, that's what you have to keep doing.
Yeah. And Brittany, I mean, you talked about saying prayers and asking for help. And Brittany said many times, hey, where are you? Where's my help? And her answer was always, hey, your help is that you can get up today.
Yeah.
And you know, although a small thing, a low bar maybe in that situation, that's the strength that she needed in that moment.
Yes.
And that's what helped her get me home and get us across the finish line.
All right. Listen, on that note, which is a beautiful note, I want to say to the audience, there's not a lot of times that I've not been able to say anything because I have a wife who's saved me many a times. So listening to Ridge is I connect with him. I connect with everything that he's talking about. You guys need to watch this State of Mind, because I think you're going to be treated by just hope, life, love, joy, mental health, the whole nine yards. I appreciate you guys coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.